This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Wilmington author Nina DeGramont bases her new novel on her own experiences during the off-season in Cape Cod. The thrill of the deserted landscape makes you feel like it's exclusively yours, but the chill of an empty town is the perfect inspiration for a love story that turns into a murder mystery. The Last September is the story of Charlie and Brett, a couple surrounded by beautiful scenery, but plagued by a troubled marriage and an unstable relative who becomes the prime suspect when Charlie ends up dead. The latest book for Nina DeGramont is this novel, The Last September. She's an associate professor of creative writing at UNC Wilmington. The Last September is on the bookshelves now, and she joins us from WHQR in Wilmington. Nina, welcome back.
Thank you, Frank. Thanks for having me.
This story is set in Cape Cod, where I understand you regularly vacation with your husband. Why did this strike you as the right setting?
Well, I wish I could say I regularly vacation there with my husband. We live there more. My husband grew up vacationing there. And then sort of early at the beginning of our careers, we moved there during the off season because we had this empty summer house. And it's just a place that, you know, can certainly capture your imagination. It's very glamorous and very populated and lovely in the summer. It's also really beautiful in the winter, but there are significantly fewer people there in the winter.
Talk about that atmosphere, living in a place that thrives on tourism and lots of sunshine when the sun goes down and the tourists are gone for weeks and months on end.
It is beautiful in September. You know, sort of the beach is empty just as it's becoming most glorious. You know, the heat has left, but the water's still warm, and suddenly the beaches that have been completely crowded are empty, and you can walk for miles all by yourself and see nobody but seals. But as the winter goes on, and when my husband David and I lived there, we were living in very much a summer neighborhood, right on this beautiful bluff overlooking the ocean, but we were the only people living in this neighborhood. And as the weather gets colder and as it starts to get darker earlier, there are moments when it feels very eerie. So you can certainly imagine, you know, sort of the tagline, who will hear you scream if something something sinister were to happen.
Well, Charlie and Brett, let's talk about them, your main characters.
Sure.
They meet in Boulder, Colorado, another scenic location.
Yes, beautiful Boulder.
What draws you to again, another and a distinct place? Why Boulder? Why did you set it there?
I went to college in Colorado Springs and then lived in Boulder for some time after I graduated and just fell completely in love with the place. It is just the physical place is so beautiful. The people are so great. And actually, there's they call it Niwot's Curse. Chief Niwot was the ousted Native American chief who, when he finally had to relinquish the valley, put a curse on Boulder Valley, saying that anyone who lived there for any length of time would spend their whole lives longing to go back. And I definitely suffer from Niwot's Curse. So if I couldn't live there again, I'd write a book that took place at least partly there.
Well, you've said that sometimes items in the news will inspire your writing, and there was something about, I think, small-town policing also that played into this. Can you tell us what combination of news and your observations about police in small towns played a part in this novel?
Sure. You know, I went from living in Boulder to living on Cape Cod, both places that are, you know, considered quite safe, very low crime rate, certainly, you know, infinitesimal murder rate. But not long before we moved from Boulder to Cape Cod, there was the Jean-Mene Ramsey murder. And, you know, as sort of was nationally highlighted, the Boulder Police Department mishandled it because they were so unaccustomed to dealing with a homicide. Mm-hmm. And then there was another murder right before we left where a young girl who was jogging in an alley was murdered, and the police let a neighbor hose all the blood away before the forensic people arrived. So when I was imagining, you know, the murder in my novel takes place in a town called Saturday Cove, which is based on the sort of Brewster, East Dennis area on Cape Cod. And I'm sure they don't have a homicide department. I mean, they would probably have to borrow from Hyannis, which, you know, doesn't see a whole lot of homicides either. So I think I sort of transplanted what I'd seen happen with the Boulder Police Department to my imagined scenario on Cape Cod.
Well, describe Charlie and Brett for us.
Brett is, when the novel opens, she is in her early 30s. She's just finishing up her PhD in English literature. She is ambitious. She's very smart, but she's, you know, spent her life kind of immersed in poetry. And she met Charlie years before when she was 18, and a very romantic young woman with very romantic ideas. And I think at one point in the novel she says, you know, Charlie sort of, she has a one-night stand with Charlie that she romanticizes all out of proportion. He disappears, and she says that's when she sort of switches from novels to poetry because she just wants to focus on these sort of, you know, capturing these sort of romantic moments and ideas.
And tell us about Charlie.
Charlie is very handsome, very charming, very charismatic. And I feel, having created him, that he's got a good heart, a lot of great qualities. He's perhaps the kind of person who should not be in a committed relationship. He has a very hard time committing to anything. He's one of those people who gets very interested in something initially and then doesn't have any follow through. And as much as Brett adores him, she being married to him proves more difficult than she imagined.
Will you read for us?
At the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
Sure. This is a scene where years after that one-night stand, Brett has moved on. She's engaged to a different, much more solid man, and she runs into Charlie at a party. It's the first time she's seen him since he disappeared years before, and she's kind of discussing the different ways she remembers that moment. And then there's this other way. The way, if I'm honest, I remember the moment most often, even now, knowing where it all led. I remember a single second where the sea of dark and pale blue, of summer paisley and Lily Pulitzer pastels, fades away. It's as if every other person at the party suddenly transforms into a thin mist of smoke, leaving him standing there, not only without a tie, but wearing blue jeans and a white and red striped shirt with a Nehru collar. Charlie, with curly blonde hair and eyes the precise color of the sky that frames him. But most important, smiling at me in a way that contains every private joke I've ever wanted to have with him. If I see arrogance in that smile, a how can you help loving me kind of knowing, I also see something else, something that looks like very genuine fondness. That affliction, the beating plague in my chest, leaps without any directive from me. If it could, it would escape from my rib cage and tackle him on the spot, like a golden retriever welcoming its long-lost owner home.
That is Nina DeGramont reading from her latest novel, The Last Summer. She's speaking to us from Wilmington, where she teaches at UNC Wilmington. I think this idea of perception, memories, how we remember what you felt when it happened the first time you laid eyes on a person, then how you remember how you felt the first time you laid eyes on a person. I mean, all of what's going on in her head seems to me central to one of the key themes in this book that really plays out in the murder mystery. We haven't even gotten to that yet. was this a murder mystery for a murder story, a story that involved murder, I guess, is a fair way to put it, from the start for you?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, I think the reason why I really think that it originated during those years that we lived on the Cape was, you know, sort of from what I was most afraid of, which is also sometimes what's most interesting to you. But the first scene that I wrote was the scene where Brett discovers her husband murdered on the back deck on their home on Cape Cod. And that's definitely where it sprang from. And many things about the novel changed over the years I worked on it, but it definitely always began with that moment.
And her perceptions going through in this novel of yours, The Last September, is I think, a key element in the book. I don't know how much we can talk about that, but how she sees things going forward and her perceptions, again, these ideas she holds in her head about Charlie and about his brother Eli, you know, are key to kind of understanding the mindset and also how the plot unfolds in this book.
Yeah, and I really wanted to do that. I really wanted to have her. The novel begins with the murder and then goes back in time, where Brett's very consciously sort of going through not only events that happened, but sort of measuring different perceptions that she had about those events that changed over time. You know, she had sort of her version of first meeting Charlie, a certain version of that after he left, and then that version changed when they got together again. And then over the course of the ins and outs of their marriage, it changed again. And she's sort of trying to stack up her own memories against what really happened as a way to try to figure out who could have killed him.
So tell us about Eli.
Eli is a character. Brett's connection to Charlie is through Eli. He was her best friend in college, and Charlie is his older brother. Eli, when we meet him, sort of the chronological beginning of the story, he is also very charming. He's a pre-med student, really promising, really sweet, really loving guy who unfortunately has a schizophrenic break. And then the trajectory of his life changes dramatically.
How important was it to you? Was that incidental to you that he would have a mental illness, or is that something that you have wanted to explore through fiction?
It's very much something I wanted to explore through fiction on many levels. And it's something close to me that I wanted to explore different aspects of it, sort of what having a family member who suffers from a mental illness does to a family. And then also how hard it is to manage that kind of disease for the person suffering from it.
So that explains your curiosity about this and your desire to explore it. Did it make it difficult, though, having a family member? And obviously there are other family members who are going to read your book. Did it make it harder for you to actually get this down?
Very much so. I do have a family member who suffers from mental illness, and I knew that I wanted a character who suffered from schizophrenia to be pivotal and a suspect in this murder. And it's sort of one of the reasons that, you know, it took me about 12 years to write this novel, and that's certainly one of the reasons I kept starting to write it and then putting it aside for the reasons that you state. You know, I was worried I would hurt people by writing it. I was worried people would be mad at me for writing it. But ultimately, I really felt like I had to get it down. And I feel, you know, I've had, you know, the novel's only been out just over a month, but I've heard from people and met people I was at readings who thanked me for that portrayal.
Can I get you to read another passage for us?
Yes. This is Charlie and Brett have just recently gotten back together, and they are going to pick up Eli from a mental hospital after he's had a break. If it weren't for Eli, Charlie and I never would have met. Still, over the years, it was difficult not to imagine what we could have been without him, the specter of his inevitable comings and goings. "Only the mad will never, never come back," wrote W.H. Auden, and I found this to be true, although the two new versions of Eli, medicated, bloated, docile, and not medicated, wild, muttering, did return again and again. But the original Eli, the real one, the boy I'd known in Colorado, the one who'd stayed resolutely beside me when his brother had not, seemed to be gone forever. Over the years, I would learn how it felt to visit or collect someone from a mental hospital, the way you brace yourself for profound and awkward unhappiness. It was especially sad seeing this in Charlie. The only time the weight of the world ever touched him was through Eli, and later sometimes me. Charlie talked a little more, telling me about the struggles they'd had with Eli since that night 7 years ago when he jumped off the roof, jumped from one kind of life, normal and promising, into another.
Nina DeGramont reading from The Last September, her latest novel. She teaches at UNC Wilmington. It is interesting. Brett is resentful of the attention that Eli gets from Charlie, particularly after their child, Charlie and Brett's child, is born, right?
Right, yeah, and I think that's something that happens. Mental illness is exhausting, and you know, professionals call it compassion fatigue. I think somebody first displays signs of mental illness. There's great rallying around them. All the energy in the family goes toward them, and what you can't really anticipate at the beginning of it is how it's something that you're going to have to live with in different mm-hmm. forms forever, pretty much. And I really wanted to contrast, you know, Charlie, for all his flaws, is very responsible and very devoted to standing behind his brother. And at the point in the novel, when we first meet them, the marriage is starting to fray. She's got this child she wants to protect from Eli, who can seem dangerous when he's unmedicated. And they're just at very different places in their ability to deal with the disease.
Yeah, I think there's that contrast that you paint in the book, and also the contrast between the nominally healthy mind and its reliability when it has to rely on memory and filters
yes.
everything through your emotions, and a nominally sick mind, a nominally maladjusted mind. Again, some wonderful contrasts that lead to some pretty deep meditations about just how trustworthy our minds and our perceptions are.
Yeah, thank you. You know, they talk about the spectrum with autism. I think with psychosis, we're all somewhere on the spectrum too.
Yeah, I mean, it's not to say that there are things that shouldn't be treated or that we all need treatment, but it does sort of bring us into consciousness about the fallibility or the reliability of our own perceptions. You teach creative writing. Is this when you do? I have often wondered about this when a teacher then has to sit down to write a book. Is it? I would think it'd be almost paralyzing. Like everything you've told those kids now comes back to you, and you think, "Oh, I better not do that." And what if they read this? Is that a problem?
That absolutely happens. But I think, you know, with any artistic endeavor, there's so much of that from so many different directions that part of being any kind of artist is mustering your courage and putting that aside. And, you know, in some ways it's good. It keeps sort of basic craft rules close at my fingertips because I'm stating them all the time. But there definitely is a moment where you just have to put all that aside. And sometimes it's interesting reading work by people who teach in MFA programs or, you know, who have come through MFA programs, and to sort of see the various little rules that we all teach that they're breaking. And sort of remember that's a choice you can make too.
That's just another page in the PowerPoint for the kids. Why I broke this rule.
That's right.
Gives you another 30 minutes to talk about it.
And usually the answer is because I wanted to.
Because I wanted to and it worked. But I have to ask you about these themes. The last time you were here, you were talking about your novel, The Gossip of the Starlings. That explored the childhood psyche. And now we're looking at this. Are these sort of psychological and emotional puzzles? Is this something that you see as a theme? I can make it a theme or a pattern in your work, but I wonder if you do.
Sure. I think if I were going to point to a theme, and it's, you know, it's not a conscious decision that I make to be interested in things like this. It just happens to be what interests me, is the kind of person who is able to draw other people toward them, even when the people being drawn know that they shouldn't be, and mm-hmm. can sort of see all the danger inherent. But the person is either so good at manipulation or so charismatic that ultimately, and usually it's the point of view character, decides to go along for the ride, even though they can see that the crash is imminent.
Always great stuff, Nina. What a pleasure to talk to you again. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Nina de Grammont is an assistant professor of creative writing at UNC Wilmington. Her new novel is called The Last September, and it is on bookshelves now. Just ahead, we learn about the fusa. It is a terrifying animal. It doesn't sleep. Well, it does. But it hunts day and night, and it will eat anything with a heartbeat. And you will find out about it on The State of Things in a moment. Stay tuned.